Welcome to another episode of Athens and Jerusalem. Let's begin where we can't escape. Let's begin with Logos.
Now, I would say that this openness, this being in the world, this referring to the world, to objects in the world, what I would like to call self-transcendence, this is disappearing as soon as you project a human being into a lower dimension than its own dimension.
The point of the V goes up to the nuclear explosion that created it.
Tell me this, Dr. Oppenheimer. Do you ever become frightened at what you're finding out here in this area that can't be measured in either time or space?
You see, that's a real point.
Do not be afraid. Open your hearts, open up your hearts.
Open up your hearts to Athens and Jerusalem. The infants of our culture, united, independent, polarized, and even bloody. Athens, the cradle of wisdom and rationality. Jerusalem, the cradle of faith and spirituality. In this podcast, we look at reunion. Could reason be more than modern secular skepticism? And could spirituality be more than belief?
All right. This week we have a very special event happening. Our first guest to the podcast. Our guest is the distinguished professor of composition at the Norwegian State Academy of Music, Professor Lasse Thoresen, who, besides being a composer of music in the modern strain, is also one who has spent, I believe, his career deeply interweaving metaphysical principles into his music. Principles having to do with the theme of this podcast of science, religion, philosophy, and their interrelationships. I would like to let Lasse introduce himself a little bit further, and then we'll jump into a conversation with him. So Lasse, please take it away.
Well, I think you said the essential thing. I've been composing since I was 16, 17 years. I was quickly fascinated by musical modernism. After a while, I realized few people understood anything when that music was being played. So I started to ask questions about what is comprehensibility in music. A lot of contemporary music was into a lot of a rather theoretical discourse, where the construction in the notes or later in the computer were more important than actually what sounded. So I started to interest myself for music as heard. And that again led me into a rather long theoretical study, not only theoretical, but applied in analysis first. And then eventually I had to give this a kind of philosophical foundation, and then the phenomenology, especially Husserlian phenomenology, became the way we anchored it also in a kind of meta perspective in relation to the analysis that we could be doing. So that is one way in which I was interweaving my musical work with philosophy. Then, of course, I have been a member of the Baha'i faith for a long time. And so the question of how, sound can reflect spiritual or even transcendental aspects of reality early entered also into my music and my work. So, well, that was briefly some of the problems I've been struggling with.
My first introduction to your work was from the oratorio that you composed. Was it the oratorio or the a great work of music that you composed for the opening of the terraces, the Baha'i terraces on Mount Carmel in the year 2000? And I remember listening to that work then, this fantastic multi-piece work that was composed the evening of the opening of those terraces. But later, just a couple of years later in Seattle, I heard you present on the theme of creation. And that's when I first met you personally. This is over 20 years ago now. And I remember this talk and being really, really fascinated by the theme, the metaphysical themes that you wove into your interpretation of art. And I'm excited to have an opportunity here to go into this a little bit with you. And maybe we could start with a quotation that that closes this paper on creation of yours from 22 years ago. And you talk something about the relationship between art and science. You say that art is solely made because of its emergent symbolic reality. Its construction, its explanation from the point of view of producing it is a different story, probably a scientific one. Its symbolic reality, however, is its essence, not the aspect of it that concerns how it is put together, analyzed, or explained scientifically. Its immediate appearance in our life world carries a significance so profound that it provides the very reason for its existence. So that really it really interests me, and maybe I could invite you to comment on the connection between music and metaphysics in your work.
Well, yes. Some things, of course, in music is basically impossible to express in words. The connection with science is, of course, one thing I had to confront when in the 1970s I started to study electroacoustic music and computer music. And since then, and before then, of course, there were intensive research in the acoustic nature of sound. One tried to create generative systems that could generate music and imitate musical creativity. Now, lately, we have had artificial intelligence that with self-learning computers that are trying then even better to imitate what humans are doing. The interesting thing is, of course, that when computers operate, they basically work on what we could call a sub-symbolic level of reality. So even, and when it works on sound, it also works on the sub-symbolic representation of sound, which is its representation in a numerical system of basically that runs down to zeros and ones that runs in a computer. And these zero and ones are extremely far from what we hear and what is actually the whole purpose of making music. So first thing I realized is that music cannot be just a sound of music, even that we perceive cannot be sufficiently explained by any technical representation of it, but it can of course increasingly be imitated. One can dwell a lot on that fact of sub-symbolic representations. And it, in a way, philosophically dates back to, for example, Descartes, who make a distinction between primary qualities of things in the world, that the extension, weight, all that can be measured somehow objectively, and then everything having to do with tastes and perception, sight, and whatever, and they are secondary, and they are, per definition, excluded from objective science. And so, at that point also, we get a split between the scientist's work and the artist's work. And so the poetic representation of reality becomes the artist's job in a way, with then the temptation to run into all kinds of subjectivity and all kinds of, let us say, more private or sentimental representations of reality. But however, I think art can go beyond that also in its representation of the life world. And of course, this split that happened between science and let's say man's experience of science have been also there have been efforts made to repair that split. For example, recently I read a very interesting summary of Alfred North Whitehead's work, mm-hmm. Process and Reality. It was made by Isabel Stengers, who worked with Ilya Prigogin on mathematical models and so on. And so I never tried and managed to read Process and Reality by Whitehead, but actually now I think she helped me to get some points. Anyway, the problem in a way still is there. And so next realization I came to when it had to do with music and sound was that what we perceive when we listen to music is what we could call an emergent phenomenon. Again, one can dissolve a phenomenon into its component parts. One can describe the component parts very often. One can even try to explain their interrelations. But what happens when you listen to music is an emergent phenomenon that in many ways completely transcends the perception of its component parts. And so music as an emergent phenomenon, that was a whole theme of a huge volume I wrote about the understanding of music as heard. Now, beyond that level where we can study music, how we perceive it and how we actually order it. And let me then mention one that in that work on sound, I had to go through actually sorting out what I could call listening intentions. So listening is just not, just I hear something. Okay, there are many things to be said about that. For example, you now hear me speaking. I'm making sound all the time, but do the sounds really interest you? Actually, not at all, if I anyway explain or pronounce English reasonably well. What you hear is what I communicate through sound. And as soon as you got the essence of what I'm trying to convey, you forget about the sounds I made. So actually, even if sound is a vehicle, it is not the sound that matters. Now, another way of listening is to say, okay, let us say we had taken away the video from our presentation and you heard my sound, and Stephen could say, and Knut Ove could say, okay, I hear somebody speaking. Who's that? Well, I hear it is Lasse that's speaking. Aha. So you can actually, in the same sound signal that I'm making now, you could infer something completely else by actually directing your conscious attention to identifying the source of the sound I'm making. Very useful way of listening when you go in the street and you hear a sudden sound, behind you and there's a car coming and you can react, You immediately think there's a car, I mean, animals have their programs there. For, a pussycat, when they hear a little scratching sound, think there's a mice and, ears go up and all of that. So that is indexical listening, which is different also from listening to the sound as such. And so what we ended up with then was to use a recipe to first actually learn to focus on sound as sound, which then in fact is a reductive act of the consciousness. You bracket in phenomenological terms the meaning of the sound, the idea of the source of the sound, and you hear simply what happens in sound. Well, that is a way to access the very basis of sound. And on top of that, now we can, start to discuss higher levels of sound and eventually then the emergent forms that music makes. And beyond that, there is what we could call the meaning of music. It's beyond all of that even. So that is another emergent level, which now carries us more into the inner world of man's consciousness. We cannot externalize that in any, you know, possible way. We can try to speak about it, we can make music about it. And that external world, we are into semiotics, and I actually also trying to make a semiotic theory of music as heard, and we have already discussed some components of that. Basically, there are several things here. There are so many things we can speak a lot about, but let's say one way in music communicates is to have the listener somewhat feel that he or she participates in the music. So simple things like boom, 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 gets somebody sit like that. And the moment somebody sits like that, it's like music, that is a signal that music, that person is moving with the music. And so then, is the meaning of the music sitting in the music, or is it actually that participation in the individual that generates the meaning, or what that individual gets out of it? You know, very often music doesn't have a kind of, this is about this, this is a statement about so and so. It is a kind of participation in the unfolding sound that generates or stimulates or releases in the listener an idea of what it could be. It could be a mood, it could be, something, it could remind about something. There is the type of iconic sounds where in which music and sound can imitate things, movements, forms, shapes. There is a metonymic aspect in which we associate, oh, I heard this music whenever, you know, I heard bum, beat him, bum, bim, bum, bum. I'm Norwegian and I've heard the national anthem. You see, that is a metonymic relation to a musical that we then, that I would attribute, and Knut Ove would attribute to that melody. Mm-hmm. And so on. Yeah. So that is simply now trying to build up an idea of what music is from the sound till the moment that we perceive some kind of meaning in it.
So your discussion of the symbolic nature of music begs the question in my mind of what is the purpose of music, and what is music essentially? Is it like a coded language that, you know, with sounds, chords, notes, you know, corresponding to words, you string them together and they correspond to sentences, and the intention is to convey some sort of meaning or some sort of information, versus, and maybe the verses here is not the, is a false dichotomy, versus the idea that music is just, you know, a combination of notes meant to create a state of enjoyment, a certain emotional state, upliftment, and so forth. I think for a lot of people, they think of music as just something they listen to because it makes them feel good. It you know, provokes a certain emotional state. But when we talk about music as a kind of code, as symbolic, as representational, then we're more into the notion of music as something which is conveying something. You know, the artist, the composer has a thought they want to convey, much like a writer has a thought they want to convey. They're just using a different medium, notes versus words. So where do you sit on the sort of maybe false dichotomy of music as something which is meant to be enjoyed versus music as something which is meant to be understood in terms of the message it's giving?
Well, I'm tempted to say that rather you would put a distinction between music understood or comprehended. No, if it's understood, then we are under the music. We, as I say, we are participating in some way. If we comprehend it, then we would say, I kind of actively grasp a message that I more or less could formulate. Mm-hmm. So the question of code or not code, well, What I mentioned, like now typical types of signs, like iconic signs and indexical signs, they are somehow natural signs, but in fact, also they depend in different degrees on some kind of conditioning and learning of codes. And so it is that music is a universal language. I'm really not sure. Anyway, if it is supposed to be, then I have found out that my music cannot be universal often, because people then say, I don't understand at all, you know, what that is about. And I think I understand perfectly well, you know, and there is a community of listeners that also like it or claim to enjoy it and understand it. Now, the question of enjoyment, well, contemporary music, of course, is what many people, you know, think of as music that rather tries to scare people off. And it has succeeded very well of scaring people out of the concert halls. So maybe, you know, the enjoyment factor isn't always big enough. But, you know, in the European tradition, this question about conveying a message or not has been there very much, you know, from let us say that the art music in Europe started 1,200 years ago in the Gothic era. And at that time, there was in the church the idea that music should represent the music of the spheres. And the spheres, they didn't have any sound, but in a kind of post-Platonic perspective, they had proportions. You know, from the creation story that Platon tells in the dialogue about the Demiurge, the Demiurge is creating the world out of three elements, which is being, sameness, and difference. And so in that dialogue, a lot of these combinations of twos and threes and ones, they generate a number of fractions. If you translate these to frequencies, you have basically all the notes in the, let's say, C major scale, if you collect them in one octave region. And that is actually that scale we have on the piano started then in the medieval ages as a Pythagorean tuning system. And the whole idea was that this tuning then, based on 3-to-2 proportions, would mirror higher realities. And in fact, then the question of enjoying music was something which was frowned upon by the priests' hierarchy. So folk music, let us say, that was the music of the devil. You know, that was for the body. It was for enjoyment and for ecstasy and all of that. Whereas the real, you know, heavenly music was mathematically founded. And so, you see, already here there is a conjoining of music and science. But at that time, science, the numbers in science carried symbolic meanings by themselves. Three was the Trinity, and one is you know, the God as you know, the creator, the unity out of which the world springs. But this just, you know, merged into a sense of harmony. And since the Pythagorean third is really false in many ways, there were, you know, hundreds of years in negotiating that contract. And while this happened, of course, words were used to convey the words of the Mass, of the Psalms, and so on. And then in the Renaissance, there happened something rather radical in that chords now suddenly were allowed not to result from the intercourse of many independent voices, but actually establish their own logic in the terms of the fundamental, the basso generale, the fundamental bass. And so The Baroque then started, you know, with Monteverdi and these people, with actually music, operas, oratorios, with a tremendous emotional effect, and there were made dictionaries about which way music could express which feeling or which emotions. And that was a part also on the introduction of rhetorics and the knowledge of the classic rhetorics into the creation of music.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, dictionaries that explain that, you know, when the basses do pop, 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 it could be used to explain, you know, to describe earthquake, or when the kettle drums do like that, it could be like thunder. And this figure, would be a seufzer, it would be a sigh, and so on, you know. So we have all of that. And so in the 19th century, there was a rather intensive debate also about concerning program music versus what they called absolute music. Now, absolute music was a philosophical concept formed in the beginning of the 19th century, because then we had got instrumental music which was not accompanied by words, and people, it was made simply because people should sit down and listen to this, only to that. And before, you know, music had been, kind of a jewel that the nobility could, you know, make themselves nice with it, or it was a church. Now it was the bourgeoisie that came into power, and they want to make up their own opinion. It's a whole idea of the Enlightenment, that you should not accept an idea that authority imposes on you if it does not comply with your own manner of thinking. So that music became also, then purified from a context in which somebody said, this is what music means. You know, you should perceive it like that. And so the music of Haydn, of Mozart, of Beethoven became very much now a music that could convey spirit, but not confession. Because church was now not anymore something that was should convey the spirit. But so the absolute music was actually a way then that the absolute meaning of the spirit could be conveyed without any, you know, telling people this is what the music expresses. And then, of course, very soon, you know, music started to express many, many specific things. And we had the programmatic music. Liszt, for example, Franz Liszt, you know, used some Beethoven's music also very much, because he wrote, you know, descriptions of things in his music. And so he said music should not be purely decorative. It should be something that is serious, describing phenomena in the world and so on. And from Franz Liszt and Wagner and so on, Berlioz, there is a straight line into the film music that you start to make in the 1930s. And so also there is a kind of code established by which film musicians, you know, select their soundtracks. So there are some kind of codes, you know, existing, and music definitely carries meanings in different ways, but now not so much as its infrastructure in terms of Pythagorean ideal relationships, but in terms of its immediate appeal and so on. Now, let me add that modernism, really avant-garde modernism that arose after the Second World War, was very much an effort to purge music from its adverse use, its bad use in Nazism, in communism, because the Nazis used it for you say, okay, we are Germans and Beethoven is a German and we are all, that's a universal, we are the most universal people on the earth, you know. And the communists used it whenever there was some uprising. They played, you know, Chopin all day to calm people down and so on. So there was there has been uses of music also that where people said, no, after this, it was a teacher who told me this when I studied in Utrecht. He said, you know, well, I tell you this, what he said to me. He said, you know, communication, he said, think about what it is. If I don't stand your face and I go up and just slap your face, that is not communication, it's violence, he said. And why is it violence? Because you couldn't resist the effect of my delivering that message. If on the contrary, I would say to you, I can't stand your face, you have the possibility to say, I don't agree. I refute your statement. So he said, what is it when I hear boom, 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 I think of people marching. Okay, who told them, where are they marching? What are they marching for? Nobody. Is that communication? No, he said. They cannot refute the message. That is violence. It is not communication. So he said, we'll have a pure communication here based on science and rationality. And so music must again be based on numbers, constructions, and all of that. And they trying to start music from a point zero. Unfortunately, then, you know, Elvis Presley and others entered the scene with bang, 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 and there we are again.
But Lasse, then I have to ask you, would you understand your own music as violence or communication?
I would say I try to communicate. I would say that. There are in a way a lot of music, a lot of listeners that are capable of refuting my music.
Because when I've tried to listen to some of your music, and sometimes it really slaps me in my face, and I can't refuse it. I'm not.
Okay. So yeah, well, perhaps it was a little bit, super idealistic to think that we could completely avoid that music could be an overpowering kind of agent, you see. So then, rather, you know, when I realized how many problems there is with contemporary music, I of course considered, should I switch over to pop music, making jazz or whatever? And then I asked myself, does that music say what I want to say? Is this what I want to say? And without being able to specify what I wanted to say, I just said, no, that's not my semantic square.
So would you say a little bit like Jon Fosse, that you're trying to say the unsayable?
Sure, all the time.
It strikes me that when we talk about music as communicating, especially in a kind of coded sense, and you mentioned that at a certain point we start thinking about music not just as notes but as words that are sung. You add lyrics to it, and when you have lyrics and music, it's almost like a multimodal form of communication. You have a supertext, which is the lyrics, which are conveying information at one level, and underneath that you have the notes that these lyrics are being sung in, and the notes themselves convey a kind of spirit, a kind of information on their own. And it strikes me that there's a bit of an analogy with language, particularly the language of poetry, where poetry also is kind of multimodal, in which you have a supertext of the words of the poem, which have their dictionary definitions and a sort of external meaning. But then you have the form or structure of the poem, which is the kind of music. It's the beat, the rhyme, you know, the meter, and so forth. Whereas, you know, with music, especially the music you write, it's music without lyrics. And so it's like trying to imagine poetry with the form and the meter, but without the words. You know, so something is being conveyed, but it's not being conveyed in the sense of literal language.
Yeah, you're very right in comparing to poetry. And, you know, poetry, as you say, has many channels by which it communicates. And one of them is sound when it is read. Mm-hmm. And especially a lot of French poetry that was made in the so-called, you know, the age of the Impressionists actually tried to convey, but also by sound, associations or moods and so on. So that's quite right. Mm-hmm.
So when it comes back to this question of the possible metaphysical role of music, you know, we can think of music as, I guess, a tool which can be incite people to charge forward on the battlefield, that, you know, incites our baser instincts and passions, at the same time that we can think of music as elevating and activating and inviting into the kind of, you know, the music of the sphere, so to speak. Can you say more about this secondary role of music as inviting the soul into a sort of closer harmony or communion with the source of things? I had in mind, if you want to start it off, a beautiful quote from that was attributed to Brahms, that was recorded by someone who heard Brahms say this about his music making process, which was, you know, which was for Brahms a very spiritual, extremely spiritual, and God infused process. The quote goes like this. He says, to realize we are one with the Creator, as Beethoven did, is a wonderful and awe-inspiring experience. Very few human beings ever come into that realization, and that is why there are so few great composers or creative geniuses in any line of human endeavor. I always contemplate all this before commencing to compose. This is the first step. When I feel the urge, I begin by appealing directly to my Maker. And I first ask him the three most important questions pertaining to our life here in the world: whence, wherefore, and whither. I immediately feel vibrations that thrill my whole being. These are the spirit illuminating the soul power within. And in this exalted state, I see clearly what is obscure in my ordinary moods.
Sure. I try to use that recipe a lot. And it works for me. Mm-hmm. Whether it reaches to the listener, I there's no way I really can guarantee that, it also depends a lot on the listener's intention or orientation, whether that listener would perceive that this is conveying a state which in certain way transcends the specific thing that you happen to hear. So that is also why I am a little bit baffled to give a very clear answer to your question. Because there is no way I can control the listener, the reception. What I have just thought is, okay, I, to a great extent, do exactly what Brahms is doing here. By the way, Brahms is supposed to have made this statement to an American journalist that visited Europe in the 1890s and interviewed European composer geniuses, because he had a theory that there must be a spiritual influence there, and so mm-hmm. he made these interviews and wanted to publish it. And this interview with Brahms, which is actually a major part of the book, it was 3 hours long. When he had made that, just a, 2-3 days days later, there comes a message to him from Brahms that he is not allowing the journalist to publish this interview until 50 years after his death. Mm-hmm. And so this interview was published in 1947 or 48, and that was a period where very few people were very curious about German geniuses, you see.
Why do you think he wanted to responded with 50 years?
Because this would indicate he was somehow religious, and his image was to be a kind of good bourgeois and not a kind of religious, you know, freak, like, for example, Anton Bruckner, who in, you know, there was a fight then between program music and absolute music. Brahms was the one who made the absolute music. He never told what his symphonies should be about. It was symphony 1, 2, 3, and 4, you know, and not like with Liszt, Hohenschlacht or, you know, Faust or, you know, things like that. Far from it. And, you know, Bruckner was then, in a way, his counterpart, although he also wrote symphonies, he was a super devoted Catholic. And everybody knew it. And so I think simply he was afraid of his image of standing forth with the fact that this was how he conceived his works. Now, others have thought that, okay, this interview is false. It's something that this journalist made up, which fits its own agenda. Now, this journalist made other interviews, for example, with Edvard Grieg. And Grieg says this and that, is a little bit foggy about, you know, inspiration. And then the journalist quotes Abel, and then Grieg said, "Oh, immediately, yes, Brahms got it. You know, that was exactly it's like that for me as well. You know, but I just couldn't, you know, express it in that way." So anyway, the authenticity of this can be disputed, but I practiced it, and I feel it to some way works. And you see, in the creative process, then there are two things. There is, and this is again, you know, we could go back to the creative world that consists is a dyadic junction of a will which has not a specific content, and a layer which contains in potentiality essences or forms. So in practical reality, I have to work with the sound material or you know, I must know my craft on in the bottom, you see. Without a craft, nothing else would work. And I'm also then engaged. I'm making experiments. I try things and make observations, and I make observation how they affect me, but still this is not composition, you see. It's like elements of composition. When I'm going to compose, and sometimes I pre-compose a sketch and so on, then I do this detour into kind of a metaphysical world, and the first step then is to forget everything. You must make your mind blank. And that is by itself a kind of meditative act. It can be rehearsed. And I worked a lot with yoga, meditation, and so on, and also with the meditation of the greatest name, which is something we daily do in the Baha'i religion. And it all is about, you know, forget before you can remember. You know, as one place Baha'u'llah says, you know, I cannot remember it now, but he says, forget everything save me and commune with my spirit. This is the essence of my command. That's it. And so there's something here. I must go into a kind of pure emptiness, and from this I then can express a purpose, an idea. I'm looking for this, I'm searching for this, I hope for this effect. What will I do with these things? And then, hopefully, this releases a kind of spontaneous thinking. And then we are speaking not about a thinking about music, but as a thinking through inner senses. The inner senses in which we can imagine music being played. So I can hear things to the extent I have, you know, notated things. I can also say, oh, that is something here. And then so that from that nothingness, the sense a kind of combined with my expressing some intention, thoughts start to flow, and I then have to be able to let them flow without interfering. Challenge is, of course, then to remember as well. And that is where my work with oral analysis and so on helps, because I can, while I imagine music being played, I can also make mental notes. So because what one can hear then in, 20, 30 seconds inner things, well, also like sometimes, your oral thinking covers perhaps 5 minutes of music, but it's just like you pass quickly through it in 20 seconds. Well, then I have to preserve that vision of what music could be like. Arnold Schoenberg once said that musical inspiration is like, imagine yourself standing in a completely dark place, and suddenly there comes a lightning, and in the flash you see the landscape, everything around you, and then it's dark again, and you have to be able to catch that picture, in your mind, and then that becomes your chart from which you can work. And of course, having done such an operation, I can even sit down and discuss it with you if this was a piece I actually wanted to write, or if I have criticisms or improvements, and I can send it back once more to see, But you see, this is a kind of inner thinking and in the inner perceptive thinking. Husserl calls it substantive cognition. And Goethe has another word for it, and he said the exakte sinnliche Fantasie, exakte sinnliche Fantasie, exact perceptual fantasy. And that's a concept of thinking, which is not really the thinking that is prevalent when you in a lot of educational institutions. However, I mean, when you read, for example, what Einstein describes, when he describes how he came to the theory of relativity, he himself describes that I was, have a kind of inner imagery in which I moved kind of different abstract things up and against each other. And eventually, when he kind of felt that sits, he, because he was a mathematician and a physician and had his training, he could translate this inner image of the cosmos into a mathematical structure, which then could be the subject of empirical testing and so on. But the interesting thing is that the way it was conceived was not through manipulation with numbers. It was an absolutely different type of thinking that led to this theory.
And talking about the mechanics, if you will, of musical inspiration, I wonder if this quotation from Whitehead might be relevant. And since you'd mentioned Whitehead before, and also Plato, this combined, and also this idea of is music something which compels you or forces you or not? Maybe this can add something to the conversation. Whitehead is talking about the evolution of religion, and he talks about an idea original to Plato, he says. Plato's publication of his final conviction towards the end of his life that the divine element in the world is to be conceived as a persuasive agency and not as a coercive agency. This doctrine should be looked upon as one of the greatest intellectual discoveries in the history of religion.
Right.
It strikes me that there's a connection here with this idea of what sort of a world do we live in? Do we live in a world in which everything we do is forced, compelled by these mathematical laws of physics? Is everything that we decide already predetermined by kind of mechanical laws? Even laws with randomness included, if you want to throw in quantum mechanics or something. Or is there an element in the world of will, which purely stated is something which is not something that coerces, but something that invites? Maybe not something that pushes, but something that attracts. And maybe the work of the musician and the compelling force of great music is is partly due to this fact that it's not forcing us, but it's inviting us into a kind of a sphere of being, which is, I don't know, more in tune with the harmony of things.
Yeah, I think that's very pertinent to what we have been discussing. And as I understand Whitehead then, he says that things of the world are basically habits of matter mm-hmm. that makes habits that make things endure. But the fact that they endure is not the result of basically of a law that we can impose upon them, but it is part of a process in the reality of achieving. So existing is in itself implies a movement towards obtaining, achieving endurance as a thing in the world. And then it says that this process of becoming presupposes an horizon of non-realized possibilities. And that actually is then what animates evolution, but does it compel it? That's another question. And so he has this philosophy of actual agents, which that more or less suggests there would be transcendent entities that guide the evolution of things, and even beyond that, a divine force that somehow makes this connection between the actual entities and what happens in the world of matter.
Hmm.
When it comes to ownership, if we really try to elaborate further on this idea on how to create something or to listen to reality and to bring, how do you understand ownership of your music, Lasse?
Well, if it comes to performing rights and authorship rights and so on, well, all that is clearly spelled out in so I can I don't say that, you know, my music is owned solely by the universe. I also refrain from saying that my music is spiritually inspired, you know, because after all, the possibilities of self-deceit is immense in that field that I am now speaking of. So I don't have this, I don't claim beyond the material rights and ownership. I cannot, I can say, well, this happened to be how music was thinking in me for whatever reason. And then, as I say, listener, whatever the listener gets out of it is again a product very much of the listener's world view and orientation. I think there are possibilities here, realized or unrealized, depending on how you look at it.
Mm-hmm. So you would say that when I got slapped in the face with your music sometimes, then it's my worldview that's, I don't, how to say it, been able to catch.
Well, you see, music is not so universal language that it always works without a certain process of learning. And that learning can be simply also on the level of listening. How do you listen? What do you listen to spontaneously? So that is a question of cultural coding in a way, and we are not all coded in the same way. So if you are not, you know, into that code, then okay. I guess if I could have give you a few private lessons, you would.
you would say it's possible to learn. Every human has the possibility to learn to grasp.
I think that if there's an open willingness to learn, I think a lot of things can be learned in that respect. And then you say, yeah, it is. I don't know. Yeah, okay. No, well, yeah, I don't know what more I could say to you.
I think this period around the 1900 was a very productive period, and it was a period where they were talking about genius, this idea about human actually being able to understand the divine, or to bring it down into human art. Do you feel yourself like in that heritage?
Absolutely, but you know, but that's an aspiration. It's not a fact.
It would be very difficult.
I don't know what more to say to your previous question. I certainly now remember what I initially thought I would say, and it is this: that of course music is great as a means of enjoyment when you understand it, and that is often what we call the beauty of music, when we feel we understand, we are completely into it, we are comfortable. However, there's been I deal with contemporary music that we are no less human when confronted with somebody, something we do not really understand immediately, but that we can enhance our humanness by training or changing our intentions and our faculties, so that we can understand more and differently. Actually, that music can be a confrontation with something initially alien, but if we manage to let's say transcend that idea of the alien and the completely other, then we expand our human, you know, capacity. Mm-hmm. So that's another, you know, part of the philosophy of the new music, that and I'm a part of that. And as you say, I am fortunately or unfortunately part of this classical culture where there was a cult of the geniuses, and I have, when my music should be played by a symphony orchestra, I'm in competition with these geniuses all the time, because they, of course, much prefer to play Brahms and Beethoven than to play Lasse Thoresen. And even the fact, if I make a major piece, I a little bit feel that, oh, are you trying to take the place of one of these divine masters? You see, what are you, you know, suggesting? Who you think you are, you know, to do such a thing? And so, I am not the one to, you know, make claims about myself and my music. I don't think it's right to do that. And ultimately, I cannot judge these things myself.
Well, we have to wait 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. So everything probably is forgotten, you see.
Yeah, or not. I think, that's a very good test for what is really worth being there. And I think that's also a test for what is true. I mean, what is truth has something to say when it's really with us for more than 100 years or something.
So you think that the national television will lift up my music in 50 years? Well, I doubt that, you see. And when you say, okay, what is with us now has, you know, kind of has tested its validity. Well, who lifts things up? What are their capacities? You know, when you speak about, let us say, this tradition after the Enlightenment with the geniuses. Well, first of all, that culture of Enlightenment was in many ways a way to get rid of the idea of the, let us say, the unity of God, in the sense that God is uniquely present in a privileged channel, like the church, that would be, you know, the body of Christ. When they did away with the body of Christ, then that spirit, and they still believed in the transcendent spirit and Christ as a transcendent, you know, spirit that animated things. Then where could you meet that spirit? You could meet it in anywhere where there was, you know, a genius that made something that could make you marvel. So actually it became then a kind of attribute or myth around everybody of these super gifted persons. And they themselves believed in their power of inspiration. The bad effect of this spreading of inspirations was, of course, that you know, in this same period we had Marxism starts, and that was also a very good idea in many respects. I mean, then you have like Anthroposophy, which is was another inspired movement by the German idealist movement, and then you have the Nazi movement that also comes out of it and is supported by the belief that individuals, wherever, whenever you think somebody is a genius, they would be a genius, and so the enormous, you know, common agreement in parts of the world that Hitler was such a Meister, a genius, became a support for his candidature. You know, even Heidegger, who I would say is an inspired philosopher, he became a Nazi. And why? He said, because he said, genius must lead the nation, not only in sciences, must also lead the nations. Democracy. Well, what is democracy? If there's a genius, he's one voice. He'll never be able to be heard. So we have to have a leader principle in which there is an inspired leader that has these privileges to decide things. And so this, of course, provokes a further question. Can democracy lift up exceptional quality? Is science, for example, scientific inventions, or I mean, also like inventions or applications, but a scientific theory, would that be a question of you know, democratic elections? We, you know, we believe in the theory of relativity. You know, how many people, you know, would raise their hands and so on. Well, it survives because there is a community of people that feel they have tested that theory and has a discourse going. And so I think also with music, there are different discourses in different environments going, and the question of survival cannot really now, I think, be uniquely decided by, you know, that this music will survive or not. People are lifted up according to a kind of agenda, which is often not, you know, specifically pronounced, but exists as a kind of, you know, understatement, agreement, doxa in a certain environment. Mm.
If we look at this metaphysically, as if the big picture is that the one becomes many and then the many return to the one, there's a phrase in Sufism that there are as many paths to the truth as there are breaths of the creatures, then there are so many different ways to return to the one, so many different pathways that one could follow. And because of the contours of this particular world, some of those pathways may end up getting grouped together in certain cultural zones, or certain pathways have become more well-trodden and others less well-trodden. But it may be that some of the narrower pathways are the deepest ones, you know, and sometimes those narrow, deep pathways may be discovered in time or rediscovered. So when it comes to things like poetry, music, various forms of art, you know, the popularity of a particular form of art or a particular musician at a particular point in time is not a necessary indication that it's the most aligned with truth or reality or what the purpose of music is. You know, even tiny communities that are deeply moved by certain art forms are part of this movement of the many back to the one.
Yeah, I think that's true.
It reminds me also of a quote from Jon Fosse. He says that because you are human, you are also Bach, even if you are barely singing the simplest melody cleanly.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a way of saying that we participate in a common humanity, even if capacities differ. So then, very wisely said by Jon Fosse.
So then it's not that important what's happening in 50 or 100 years. So.
Well, I resign myself to the fact that most composers, 10,000s of them, are forgotten. And when you start to open some of these forgotten composers' works, they are not bad, many, many of them. I mean, there have been glimpses of inspiration in many places. But then, of course, some of these people are truly exceptional, and they were lifted up by, you know, competent listeners that were in a position to give these people a name. None of them were PR agents by themselves. They all depended on a community that valued their achievements, and a community that had a certain also connection with the power to decide where what should be played, what should be exposed, what should be shown, what should be explained, what should be researched. And well, so like Heidegger say that you know, the creator and the one who creates the awareness of the created work are actually on the same level. So, you know, in German, you know, and in Norwegian we say "være," var means to be, you know, attentive, and to make or gjøre folk to make people aware. You see, to be aware is the same where, and to awaken awareness is a role of the preserver, the one who bevarer, who is preserving, and without the preserver, what is created will, even if it has some truth to it, will easily just, you know, disappear.
Manifestation of that primordial dyad of the giver and the receiver, the B and the E.
I often think of this not as a dyad, but more as a triad, that we have the giver and the receiver, but there's always something that is being given. And this, what is being given, I think is the third. And I often think of it as the matter or the essence or the metaphysical case being brought into.
I think that's completely true, because you know, the one and the two is a polarity which is bound the one to the other in a kind of necessary and paradoxical situation. But then the between these two things are created, which is the third thing. Which is one when the, you know, the lightning strikes, and something is you know, like prodded out of potentiality into actuality.
And I also think that Husserl is completely correct when he says that we are always intentional, we are always drawn towards something, some matters. That there are not only this dyadic, I think so.
Yes. Intentionality gets into your third, you know, what you call your third dimension. I actually made a kind of semiotic model, which was based on that triplicity that you are discussing, which was central to Peirce, the philosopher Peirce, and his semiotic theory. But I didn't really follow him very carefully. But then I say that the sign, you know, the sign with a great S, which is like defined in the medieval ages, is something stands for something else. Mm-hmm. Aliquid stal pro aliquod, you know, is what they say. That what is that? Well, a sign is always a perceptual entity, like a sound, like a visual thing, you know. But that sound or visual thing stands for something else. That it is the signifier. The signifiant is what you perceive, the signifier, this the intended meaning, which is actually then a part of the invisible universe, because that is what we perceive in our minds and souls, for example, when I'm making these sounds that we are speaking. So it passes from this perceptibility to an invisible world. But what is a link? And that is the third thing. And then in music, I then reasoned that there are basically perhaps only three ways by which this transition could happen. And I say one is an intention. And we are in exactly into what you say here, and the Husserlian intentions. There is intention then to see what is the cause of that material perception. And that's an indexical intention. Then there is an iconic intention. What does it resemble? You know, a drawing resembles something I've seen in the world, or so on, so on. And there is a metonymic thing. What are the connotations of this? I mean, when I experienced this thing when I was there and there, and it meant so and so to me that time, and so on. And then there's a fourth one, which is the arbitrary science, which was central to Saussure and his linguistic theory and the theory of the French structuralism and so on. And that says that this relationship is arbitrary. It has to be learned. It is learned by definition and not by, you know, simple, you know, living in that world. And it applies, of course, to mathematical symbols and reading score and the notes of the score and so on. And then when you start to look into it, also, for example, the iconic science, that which is based on similarity. Well, you know, in the computer now, we have a lot of icons, small little things, which are much more compact than, you know, stating the name of it and more universal to understand than if it was written in English or Norwegian or whatever. But nevertheless, you have to have an explanation to find out what these icons is, even if it shows a hand. What does that mean? Well, it means you can drag or push or something, you know, on the screen, but you have to, you know, get that connection. So in fact, you know, a lot of creative activities in poetry, for example, poets tries to find fresh, original metaphors. So that by cracking that, you know, question mark, which a metaphor by implication is, the reader can imagine and see in a different way, perhaps, that object which the poet intended. However, some of these poetic metaphors become conventional, and by degrees, eventually, they enter into the language as ordinary words, which we then can learn. And we don't think of it anymore as fresh. So there is a passage here from signs that have a certain immediacy and are original, and they pass eventually into convention, and they then eventually enter the coded dictionary. So this is a very fleeting reality. But anyway, this triadic thing, there is a visible, the invisible, there is a link between them, which is what they're called a semiosis, the process of finding meaning in a sign. The semiosis has also then an aspect of cultural training and conditioning, even in many cases.
Yeah. I think maybe we should end there, Lasse. I think in a way we started with symbolic science, and then we ended in a way back in the loop after a long conversation. And I think also that I really hope that the listener have had the same joy as I have had to listen to you, and really made me think a lot of both on music but also on phenomenology. So really, thank you.
So thank you for inviting me to speak, and it was great to have this conversation with you, and you give me all this, you know, prods that I can't resist giving lectures. You know, my wife sometimes said to me, you know, I mean, we're in the party now, watch out now, you are pushing his lecture button, you see. So,
but it's really nice to listen to you, because you're so clear, and the way you have like a logical way of thinking through different perspective. I really liked it, and it was very easy for me to follow. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Athens and Jerusalem, created by Cameron Namdar, Stephen Phelps, and Knut Ove Essay. Nora Juhl is the broadcast voice and technical support. Music is pieces of Edvard Grieg's Morning Mood. The voices in the intro are Viktor Frankl, interview with Robert Oppenheimer, and Pope John Paul II. Thank you for listening, and please check out another episode.